Hi, I'm Rachel Smith, and this is the MadTech Podcast, fast and furious news for the MadTech generation. Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of the MadTech Podcast. Delighted to have as our very special guest, the gaming economy editor, Matt Broughton.
Hello.
Hello. How's it going?
Not too shabby, sir. How's you?
That's good. Yeah, not too bad. Just enjoying our new speedy format. Means I can fit more things into the diary. It's quite exciting. Lindsay, how are you over there in the Walthamstow Studios?
Just trying to stay awake.
Poor Lindsay. Suffering from severe sleep deprivation. Do you think it may be accelerated during that little heat wave that we had a couple of weeks ago? That probably really wrapped it up a bit.
That probably was the start of things to come, I imagine, for me.
Yeah. Yes, many challenges.
It's gone downhill since then.
Never mind. Like I said, we've got the MadTech Podcast to keep you awake. And all
about... Nation tonic.
That's it. All of our listeners as well. Right, let's get started with our new speedy format. First news story. Let me press the start button on the timer. Okay, first news story. As I was explaining to Lindsay yesterday when we were talking about the news stories we wanted to talk about this week, it's a little bit of continuation week on week at the moment because August is kind of slow for news and because there's some really entertaining spats happening in the world of advertising and marketing technology. And so the story I'm returning to this week is the Apple and Epic Games story, where there's been a development early on in the week with a US district judge in California ruling that Apple cannot block Epic Games from using the Unreal Engine developer tool. That probably made a few other developers in the gaming industry feel a little more confident that they will also be able to get access to the tool as they would normally, because they're a little worried that Apple might block it for more people than just Epic. But the judge ruled that Apple was still within their rights to make Fortnite to refuse to make Fortnite available in the App Store. So we're at an impasse. Where is this going to go next? You know, it feels like it's a very deliberately public argument. We know that, you know, Epic kind of sort of taunted Apple into making their sort of latest maneuver, and Epic have used this, rightly so, as an opportunity to create a campaign to raise awareness of the ways in which Apple treats the developer community in general, not just gaming developers, but anyone that's developing an app for consumption in the App Store. So where do you think this is going to go? We know that Apple are on the brink of making another announcement about IDFA, which is rumoured to be obviously being obliterated, for want of a better way to describe it. That's going to have massive impact on anyone that's trying to target advertising in an app environment, in an Apple operating environment as well. So, you know, are these issues kind of corralling around the same period of time to make the IDFA issue even more sort of obvious and pertinent? And I also wanted to know what you guys thought. It was a couple of weeks ago now that it was released, but I also wanted to just have a quick chat about Epic's free Fortnite ad campaign, which is a parody of Apple's 1984 advert. And just hear a word from the both of you on what you think of that from the point of view of an advertising and marketing gimmick. Matt, gaming guru, let's start with you.
So firstly, I think I'm kind of very glad that the court has ruled in this way. It seems the completely fair decision, because it would be an utter travesty for the third party developers, particularly indies with their limited access to resources, to suffer as a result of two multi-billion dollar companies pointing fingers at each other going, this isn't fair, at a time when we're going into, you know, an economic crisis that rivals the Great Depression. It was clearly against App Store rules to put in a payment system of their own. And obviously, likewise, it was, you know, far too strong a retaliation from Apple to go, okay, we're going to withdraw access to Unreal Engine, where it had nothing to do with the dispute. There was a sort of really nice sentence in the court ruling where it said that the economy is in dire need of increasing avenues for creativity and innovation, not eliminating them. Epic Games and Apple are at liberty to litigate against each other, but their dispute should not cause havoc to bystanders. which kind of puts me in mind of a sort of marriage counsellor pointed at them going, think of the children, for goodness sake. In terms of sort of where it goes next, I think Epic's goal is to sort of have its own ecosystem, have its own storefront. And I can't see that happening even with the additional sort of antitrust scrutiny it's facing from the US and the EU. Now that, like you said, it's sort of made it a bit of a stalemate, I can't see any way that either of them could really up the ante. So I'd imagine it'll be a case of it kind of petering out. Maybe Epic gets a sort of 15% cut on its commission, kind of like how the deal they've got with Amazon, in sort of return for not publicly slating them. But I think sort of going really into sort of what I call crystal ball looks, sort of complete nonsensical look at the future, I think Epic's hand would be stronger if it had its own smartphone. For this, it would need sort of close ties with a non-Apple and non-Android ecosystem, one which has, you know, strong social and e-commerce ties, kind of like the thing you'd get if you're 40% owned by Tencent. And also you'd need a sort of hardware partner, which is a bit more palatable to US audiences, kind of like the kind of thing you'd get if Sony had invested $250 million in you last month, which they did. So potentially that's an avenue for them to go down in the future.
Yeah, interesting. But see, you know, it's interesting. So if they came to a deal with Apple about, you know, some kind of a reduction in commission in the App Store, what about all these other indie devs that they've tried to bring along on the argument of how Apple treat them so unfairly? Like, you know, Epic have really gone down that moral crusade argument. It's a bit difficult to back away from that and accept any concessions that are given just to you.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's a PR move at the end of the day. It's not like Epic Games has kind of form in terms of how they aggressively targeted putting exclusive contracts on its Epic Games Store on PC games, sort of taking them away from Steam, obviously in a more sort of way that benefited the consumer and the developer, but it's kind of those deals are kind of too good to be true in terms of a long-term sustainable business model. They, you know, gave those deals to be as good as possible so that it basically takes market share from Steam. And if they feel at a point when they've taken enough market share, those deals will kind of go away.
The ruthless big business owners, really. Okay, that's interesting point of view. Lindsay, what's your point of view here?
I think what's interesting to me is two things. The timing of this is interesting. So obviously Epic will have been sitting on this for a long time. It's not like there's not been conversations with the likes of Apple and Google about these fees for a long time. Epic have made it well known for a long time that they're not happy with 30%, as have other developers too. But their next season of Fortnite launches next Thursday. And I'm kind of wondering if they're trying to do this at a time when everyone's going to want to have access to the new season. Now, they can't do it on the App Store. They can't do it on Android. Can they do it on the PC version instead, where Fortnite Epic Games charges a much more reasonable fee to its marketplace, or accessing the game directly through Epic's own kind of version of the App Store that they created to try and get people to access the game directly. If you did that kind of mid-season, would people want the same access to it that they might do from a new season launch? But I think also what interests me is the demographics of the Fortnite player, because if you think about this from a messaging perspective, and I do love the 1980 Fortnite messaging. I think it's really good, and it's, you know, very tongue-in-cheek, and it would definitely kind of has the impact. But I'm also wondering, if you're trying to get your audience on side, if your audience care enough to go on side with you. And there's some, I found some stats. So, you know, there's 350 million active players of Fortnite. 62.7 of them are between 18 and 24. But then there's new findings that 53% of players are between 10 and 25. So if a vast majority are under 18 and probably and potentially even between the ages of 10 and 13, where the parents have control over what they're playing or kind of what access to devices they have, you know, are they even going to be able to kind of to join this fight with Epic as Epic would potentially want them to? Epic want their hundreds of millions of players on side, and if they're all children, do they care? Do they just want access to the game? Will they find something else? What we one thing we know about this generation is that they are not loyal to brand. They're not loyal to things. The second the new shiny thing comes along, they will go to that instead. So if you know if the next season of Fortnite is new and shiny, fantastic. This might well work. But if it's not, they might just go on to something else. But also, I totally see the point of you know this. I was looking at how much revenue Epic has made through Fortnite. And there's, again, stats that obviously Epic probably haven't released themselves, but have been calculated. 70% of players paid an average of $85 back in 2018. If we assume that's the same, and let's, for argument's sake, assume all of that was on the App Store, was on Apple's App Store, you know, that's $1 billion in revenue for Apple off of $3 billion in revenue for Epic. So it is a ridiculous amount of money. But yeah, I was just kind of interested in the demographic of Fortnite. When I found that, I was like, well, is it really a fight for them to make? Are they really going to be able to get people on side that will join them in this? From a business perspective, and Matt, from the points you were making, totally makes sense. But if you think about it from the kind of the trying to get your audience on side, I just can't see it working the same way.
And it's interesting, actually, because like you say, audience of that age perhaps are not loyal. Oh, time's up. That'll teach me for asking a compound question. Hang on, let me just finish this last thread. They're not loyal, but they might be. But they might be highly addicted, though. And so, you know, they might do everything that they can possibly do to, you know, make their parents' lives hell unless they're able to have access to the things that they want, the things that they need, and also. Because perhaps the pursuit of gaming in a family household is so much more obvious, perhaps, than, let's say, playing outside of the household with a bunch of friends. Maybe parents are a little more, they might not necessarily be tuned into every element of what's happening in their children's gaming lives, but they might be much more attuned to the concept of it overall. And therefore, if their kids are talking about this fantastic ad that, you know, that that Fortnite released, the Epic released through the Fortnite brand, or they're talking about how they haven't been able to get access to it, then that might be something they're just more acutely aware of, I suppose. And ultimately, I mean, you know, Matt, you raise a good point. At the end of the day, maybe Epic is just looking to corner as much market share of the various elements of, you know, of the game that they can monetize as possible. And they'll try every route that's, you know, every avenue that's open to them. Yes. Okay, good. Compliantly, everyone's going, I'm not saying anything else, time's up. Right, moving on to story number two. Facebook launched, dear me, it's not a good day. Wow. Facebook launched a news tab in the US, and they've accelerated the launch of this internationally. I think they were due to do this anyway, but they've brought it forward. So this is a separate part of the site, new tab, where people can actually access all of their news and news feed activity. They are claiming that this will be a mechanism for driving more revenue for publishers, presumably because it will perhaps drive audiences to news as an explicit experience within Facebook, as opposed to it just being littered throughout a regular, well, what's been known as the news feed. And also they are creating an environment where publishers will have to, you know, meet a certain level of compliance in order to be able to be featured on this tab. They are talking about there being compensation arrangements for publishers that are participating in this, but they're not explicit about what those compensation arrangements will be. And they've also said that they will be, you know, working to try to agree the best ways to feature news within the news tab with international publishers, depending on what consumption habits are like within individual markets. Now, what's interesting about this is I wonder if it's an effort for Facebook to be acquiring international audiences and growing their international audiences faster. What's also interesting is that they are releasing it at a time where they're up against so many anti-competition complaints in various international markets, not least of all the argument that they're having with the ACCC in Australia over their new media code, which is trying to implement a fair way for publishers to be paid and compensated for any you know, revenue that's made off the back of their news-related content. The argument being that Facebook makes a hell of a lot of revenue off the back of user numbers, which are generated by the content. So What's your point of view on this? I'm interested to know if it feels as though this might be Facebook, as I said, trying to time this release with lots of other negative press that's happening at the moment, or whether it's actually a genuine opportunity to introduce a new monetization sort of vehicle for publishers. Lindsay?
I think it's all about timing. I read somewhere, kind of, that somebody made the comment, and it was a very interesting comment. It was curious that Facebook is talking about doing this about 6-12 months ahead of actually launching it, which is unlike Facebook. Normally they go, right, we're doing this tomorrow. This is all done, dusted. You can't complain about it. It was strange that they have decided to announce this at this time. And I feel like there's good reason for that, because there is the arguments with Australia and ACCC. And obviously Australia has been left off the list of countries that Facebook is looking to launch the Facebook News tab. And I guess given what Australia is trying to do, the Facebook News tab doesn't work in this context. But there's also a lot of EU stuff going on. So there kind of a lot of battles with France at the moment. Google's publicly battling with France about the payment of journalists and Google News. We know that obviously Spain, Google News has been shuttered in Spain as well last year. So I think that there's the ongoing France battle. I think Germany has to ratify the EU regulation around publisher monetization and publisher journalism monetization in the next year or so, similar to what France is doing at the moment. And Facebook announcing this now feels very much like, on that perspective, they're trying to kind of let everyone know, we are doing things, we're going to be doing this to help you. Don't try and start a fight with us. Let Google do all this publicly. We'll have these chats privately. And publicly, what we'll say is, we're going to be allowing many of your publishers to actually get money from us. To kind of make them all realize that they're not involved in these kind of broader conversations about the challenges of regulation when it comes to journalism and content, publishing content in these markets. But I also wonder if there's some kind of like iOS 14 play here as well with IDFA and Facebook announced literally yesterday evening that they are just not going to bother collecting IDFA on iOS 14 devices. And there were rumors going around about that beforehand that they were going to say that. And they may not even include Audience Network. And I kind of wonder, and they've said at that time, you know, as, alongside saying this, like, we basically aren't going to bother with iOS 14 because it seems like a lot of work, probably for not the right return. They basically said, publishers, you're going to see a massive dip in monetization, in revenue, and advertisers, you're going to see a massive dip in performance. So actually talking about, on the one hand, talking about how they're going to be helping publishers with the news tab and launching it in new markets, at the same time as saying to publishers, you're going to lose money. There's going to be a lot of in-app money lost for you through the lack of IDFA. If they're trying to kind of do some sort of counterbalance, I could be reading too much into it, but the timing of it seems, like this person said, 6-12 months before it's due to launch, they're shouting about it. It just seems strange.
Mm. Matt?
So I think sort of on the point of the growth in international traffic, I think they definitely need that, because I think there's going to be some difficult shareholder questions coming up when asked over its strategy over the next sort of, you know, 12 to 24 months, with IDFA set to shave off about 50% of its audience network revenue. And eventually it might just go, nah, we'll just not bother with that, with audience network on the Apple ecosystem as a whole. And then you've got, you know, the more trendy rivals like TikTok coming to the fore, and WhatsApp, where, you know, they haven't really kind of, you know, got a solid monetization strategy for that, it seems. There may be sort of difficult questions going forward. So I think if they're, you know, pointing shareholders towards the fact that, yes, we're going to grow international traffic through these premium news sites, then, you know, that may stave off those questions. And they do need those sort of premium articles from reputable publishers with, you know, journalistic standards, as it distances the Facebook platform from the perception that it's just, you know, the platform for your racist neighbours, for having a marital row in public, or Auntie Mildred asking her 4 followers for their opinion on her feet. Like, it needs, you know, to have its perception as a more premium platform, especially when you've got the, you know, elections coming up in the US, and you know how they had so much shtick in the last elections over how, you know, in terms of the Cambridge Analytica, things like that. In terms of what the upside for publishers is, I think it's kind of lip service at best, I think, because it's all well and good saying publishers are going to get a great deal out of this, but when it's not spelled out in full, then how can, you know, how can we sort of believe that is the case? As noted in the Axios article, it says, as is true in the US, not all participating publishers will necessarily be paid, and publishers that produce more content will likely receive bigger payouts. So it's going to reward those, you know, the companies that produce sort of high churn articles. It will appease sort of the mainstream media somewhat. So there may be sort of less noise about how Facebook is kind of taking a lot of money off the plate. But, you know, the small sort of boutique and local news publishers, they're not going to really receive much of a benefit from this, I think.
As usual, right? Like, they seem to be the ones that are suffering across the board, regardless of what's implemented. And Lindsay, I think you raise an important point, which is, yes, if you look at this from a timing point of view, it feels as though it's Facebook making an attempt to, you know, design and deliver something that could result in additional revenue for publishers at a time when the likes of Google are, you know, outwardly pushing against any regulation that's trying to do that separately. But the part of me feels like that's just a bit wafer thin, right? It's definitely Facebook making an attempt to do that, but is that really going to result in additional revenue generation for publishers, particularly small publishers? And what also strikes me, I mean, you know, your IDFA point's really, really important as well, Lindsay, is that actually if you are a small publisher, you're just going to feel irritated by all of this across the board at the moment. You know, at the end of the day, once again, your content is being used to generate money for others. You've still got to pay your journalists and create a business model that is, you know, has got some kind of recurring revenue. And it's just becoming harder and harder. You know, you're just and you're being controlled by, yet again, Facebook, Apple or Google. It just feels like a depressing place to be, particularly for smaller publishers. Larger publishers probably have a little more options at their hands, at their fingertips, and have probably got better access to user data that they could monetize in other ways.
I think the challenge with this is that, the internet created the opportunity for these smaller publishers that can cover any form of variety news, you know, kind of gardening monthly, you used to buy from the magazine, buy from the local corner shop. You can now kind of like access tons of content on the internet about the most like the absolute minutiae and like really, really niche topics. And I think that the internet created it and is now not delivering any way of supporting it. But what Google News would argue is, well, we gave you this platform to be able to grow your business in the first place. We're not responsible for maintaining it. You are responsible for maintaining it. So actually it's our, you know, we've done this for you. It's not our fault. If we want to go and change the rules, we can do that. It's up to you to learn how to evolve or die. And, you know, you like Apple making the same argument with Epic. Apple, you could argue Apple's 30% commission is, well, we took the risk of creating this app store and Android as well. We took the risk of creating this app store, allowing you the platform to produce these games and produce these apps and grow a massive audience through us. You couldn't have done it without us. We haven't increased our commission for the past 12 years. And actually, you know, what we're taking is probably a fair cut for the risk that we took to help you grow your business. Now, I'm not saying I agree with that, but they are points that I think people will make. Google News certainly have in the past. They've said, it's not our problem. We've given you this massive platform. You wouldn't have half your traffic without us. So put up or shut up.
Speaking of put up or shut up, time's up. But Matt?
That was good. That was good timing.
So final word from you, Matt.
Just on that point where, yes, they have taken those risks to build those platforms, but now that those platforms are so big and established, they will have knock-on effects as soon as they make any changes. And it's kind of in Facebook's blog post, which we brought up earlier about them talking about the IDFA changes. It said, we believe that industry consultation is critical for changes to platform policies. When they change their platform policies, which, you know, affect these smaller publishers, do you think they were consulted? I don't think so.
Oh, no, I know they wouldn't have been. They'll go where the money is every time.
Absolutely. And even if they are consulted, it's very lip service related. It's not, you know, it's for the sake of it rather than anything meaningful from what I can tell. I think the thing I just want to say one final word on this before we move on. I think the thing that's interesting about this, you raise a good point, Lindsay. You know, a lot of the a lot of businesses that we're talking about wouldn't necessarily have been able to thrive the way that they have if they hadn't had access to these platforms in the first instance altogether. But the real issue is that there's no competition to any of these platforms, because in any other marketplace where that was your arrangement, I'm thinking, for example, like, you procure an agent to represent, to rent your house for you because you've moved out of it, moved to another country or whatever. In the first year, they charge you X percentage of commission because they're doing more work for you. They're finding a tenant, they're vetting them, they're doing all of that sort of stuff. Then they're not doing anything else. And so over the remaining 4 or 5 years of that tenancy, while you've still got the same tenants in place, the commission fees reduce because they know that at any point you could take over the management of that property and you could go and find another agent to do exactly the same job, or you could decide to do it yourself. In this environment, there is no competition.
No, I think food delivery is an example as well, actually. Food delivery, where there are low barriers to entry if you're a Deliveroo or Uber Eats. You know, in this country, you've got three well-known ones, Deliveroo, Uber Eats and Just Eat. In some markets, there are 20, 30, 40 of these, and the ability to be able to put your restaurant or your shop on all of them is an opportunity. But when it comes to the news content or kind of anything else internet-related, you can't do it.
That's right.
It exists.
Yeah. And so it becomes a competition conversation again, right? Okay, moving on. Third news story of the week. Excuse me. Third news story of the week. Group M have released their global marketing monitor, which they release with some regularity, authored by Brian Weiser. Gives a really interesting sort of bullet point rundown of what's happening in the world of marketing. The monitor that they released at the start of this week was focusing explicitly on e-commerce, and there was a couple of really interesting points that came out of it. Tracking e-commerce growth and activity for the month of July and also for Q2. So I just wanted to highlight a couple of really interesting points on that. The first is that the UK's e-commerce activity accounted for 28% of overall retail sales in July. And those retail sales were up 2.7% in July. So obviously very small percentage increase, probably because of the, landscape backdrop of global chaos that we're operating in. But what's also interesting is that overall, the UK e-commerce sector rose by 54% in total. So that's, beyond retail in July, which represents faster growth than has been seen in either the US or in China. And for comparison, the growth in the UK e-commerce sector overall for Q2 was 55%. So July kind of represents a very similar growth rate to that over the entire quarter, which suggests that the rate at which it is growing is probably relatively sustainable, relatively real, not just a blip that's necessarily going to dip in another month's time. The other thing that was interesting for comparison is that the e-commerce share of retail in China in July was only slightly higher than the UK at 32%. So that really provides a nice bit of comparison between what's happening in the UK and what's happening in China in terms of growth, and shows that the rate of growth in the UK is much more similar to the way that the e-commerce sector is unfolding in China than it is perhaps in the US and elsewhere. The growth in retail e-com came unsurprisingly mostly from food and household goods, but they weren't exclusively just food and household goods. Those were the real drivers though. Another couple of interesting points as well is that the global luxury e-com sector or retail sector rather fell by 40% year on year, which probably isn't surprising. But what's really interesting about that is that it dipped 14% in Q1 and then a massive 40% in Q2. And I wonder what that says about luxury consumption in general. The other point I wanted to pull out of this was TV consumption in the US. Now, Group M was specifically looking at the US, probably because there's a lot more data and numbers available there, but also too because I suppose within the kind of, connected TV world and the advertising and marketing world, since there's such a proliferation of streaming opportunities in the US, it's seen as a little bit of a point of reference. So I thought it was interesting for us to just reflect on this, which is that internet-connected device consumption rose in the US in July by 32%, and it accounted for 21% of overall TV viewing. And within that, internet-connected device viewing was 37% for under 34s. And that's probably, that represents a kind of continued growth in the uptake of streaming TV services, whether that's via a connected device or connected TV. And it also shows the degree to which that is making up a sort of growing and significant percentage of overall TV viewing. I don't know what the comparisons are in the UK, but it's just interesting to think about this in the US in the first instance. The other interesting stat that came out from this was comparing what was happening with streaming platforms in the US from Q2 this year to Q4 last year. And what we saw is that Netflix are still enjoying an increase only of about 3 percentage points. So their share of market was up to 34%. But the other closest competitors, which are YouTube and Hulu, now at 20% and 11%, were down 1 percentage point from Q2 last year. So actually, you know, Q4 last year. So Netflix is enjoying still a kind of accelerated rate of growth. And YouTube and Hulu are down slightly. Amazon's share of market remained the same, and Disney Plus entered the market and got themselves a 4% share of that market. There was a lot of other interesting stuff around US TV viewing that I don't think much of it was that interesting for our point of conversation, because it doesn't seem comparable to other international markets. So, interested in a perspective on those figures, e-com, luxury market, and TV consumption. Matt, let's start with you.
So, sort of on e-commerce, it's not a new trend. It's just a trend that has been accelerating year on year, and COVID's just kind of really brought it to the fore. In terms of things like luxury market, I'm sure there'll be a bounce back in ones like those, because at the moment I'm not sure there's much of a market for Louis Vuitton handbags and Ferraris when you're sat having a quiz on Zoom with your mates. But, you know, people ultimately are creatures of habit, and I think not being able to go to the high street when previously that would be their, you know, shopping method of choice, it's broken that habit, and they formed new ones on through e-commerce. And now, even as the high street begins to reopen, it may be difficult for them to go back to that, because they're, you know, seeing the benefit of shopping online, chilling at home in your slippers. In terms of how sort of the growth is comparing in the UK to the US, I think, you know, uncertainty is everywhere, but it's no more so than the US at the moment, given, you know, the spiraling COVID cases and election, which is already being disputed by Trump as the most unfair one that's ever to take place, even before the polls have opened. So I think the environment in the UK and Asia, even though, you know, the landscape isn't perfect at the moment, but it's a bit more conducive to these new, you know, challenger brands opening up, and, you know, predominantly through e-commerce.
Yeah. What about the TV stuff? A point of view on that?
So in terms of the TV side of it, I think, you know, in terms of how streaming is growing, I think it's a matter of choice, simply because in terms of traditional forms of TV, you don't have that quite same level of choice and availability that you get through streaming sources. I've, you know, been predominantly through streaming services for many years, but, you know, we talk often about there's this London bubble and we should look outside of that. But when you've got, you know, long-standing TV hits, you know, like EastEnders, they're only just, you know, restarting filming, and then they haven't been available for new episodes. I'm not an EastEnders fan by any means, but if that was, you know, you would sit down of an evening to watch that, that's now no longer available, and you would look to other forms of entertainment, and streaming being one of them.
Yeah, good point. We're running out of content, I suppose, in some respect. Lindsay?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of retail in general, I feel like we're still in a bit of a bubble, and I think that most things are going to, in the UK in any case, most things will continue to drop. I think luxury at the moment will continue to drop, but, you know, as, you know, Matt was saying, it definitely will see an uptick. I think luxury will evolve as everything else will have to evolve in terms of the kind of products that they produce. You know, we talk a lot about makeup and how beauty companies are having to evolve because people aren't wearing makeup as much as they were. And if they are, they're not wearing lipstick because they're wearing masks. So they're looking at promoting their skincare products rather than their makeup products, their beauty products instead. So I think we'll see a lot of that in terms of how luxury brands evolve and produce new products. You know, are you going to be buying a Louis Vuitton suitcase? Probably not anytime soon, but you might by something else, Louis Vuitton, they've created that, that's more appropriate to the current setting and this new normal. But I think that, that retail in general is quite fascinating for me. I think that if you are a retailer that doesn't hold stock, then you're a winner in this, because any retailer that, that holds stock, and many, many do, are struggling because they now got to get rid of loads of stock. They've got to take, you know, a massive markdown on it, and they had to try and replenish for next season. I think any retailer in that situation at the moment is in a massive challenge. And so the opportunity for them to be able to go and look at e-commerce as an option has been great. And necessity, of course, is the mother of invention. And there's been, you know, a lot of kind of independent retailers that have made great strides in e-commerce. And I think the fact that we are actually exceeding China in terms of growth in terms of e-commerce growth. I mean, China, we're not at a low base. China have got, kind of got e-commerce nailed anyway. But the growth that we've seen, you know, points to us being ready for it as a market. You know, we're small. There's not probably the same logistic challenges that there are maybe in the US, kind of where there's more kind of intrastate challenges. But we I think we're embracing this, and I find that very interesting. And actually, in terms of like the retail high street in general, I was chatting to someone yesterday who said a friend of his, you know, is senior at a kind of well-known high street clothing retailer that's got significant in-store footprint. And they were saying that, you know, before this, all their big inner city retail stores were absolutely booming, and they were the ones keeping the company alive. And all the high street ones were really struggling to the point where they were going to close them down. And now that's completely flipped on its head. And now the big inner city ones are not getting any business at all. Mm-hmm. And the high street ones have seen a massive resurgence. So I think we're going to see a lot more of that as well. We talked in the past about these 15-minute communities, and everyone's hanging out more around where they actually live rather than where they work. And I think that's going to change the face of the kind of the high street as well in times to come. So I think the whole thing is just fascinating to look at.
That's a really interesting point, actually, that, yeah, our neighbourhoods and environments where we spend time is changing, and so that might be an opportunity for retailers and for high street retailers. But also you raise a good point about where we are in how we're positioned in the UK, the sort of perspective of logistics. Obviously, news this week, one of UK's biggest and now probably most well-known D2C brands, Gymshark, just got an enormous amount of investment from General Atlantic and an enormous valuation. And I think when their owner was interviewed on Sky News, he was asked, you know, how sort of optimistic do you feel, or where are you going for growth? And his first question was his first answer to that question was the US, but we're continuing to grow elsewhere. And then the second question was, and how optimistic do you feel about the growth of your company and the growth of other retail outlets, and particularly online and e-commerce outlets in the UK? And his answer to that was extremely positive and enthusiastic, because he said in the UK, we've got fantastically sophisticated infrastructure. We're a densely populated, quite small country where we can make the logistics of people getting convenient deliveries and convenient returns work really well. We've got really sort of still very sophisticated infrastructure in terms of stock control and warehousing. And we've got a lot of talent that we can employ within the country to make all of that work at a cost-effective rate. And I thought that was really interesting, because also too, not to go on and on about Gymshark, I don't know why this is in my head, but he was also talking about how he'd started the company near to where he lives, which is in the West Midlands, and how that was a manufacturing base for a long time in the UK and probably still is to some extent. And that you know, that means it's a great place to set up a company which relies on logistics and warehousing and all of those sorts of things. And I thought, yeah, actually, there probably is a lot about the e-com sector that we're sort of underestimating in terms of ways in which you can grow. It's not just about sort of dominant products. It's about, you know, that last mile delivery, how all of that works effectively. And I have to say, I don't know what your experiences have been during COVID, Matt and Lindsay, but pretty much anything I've had delivered and anything I've had to return during this period, I feel like it's even more efficient than it's ever been before. I feel like delivery is just sort of really ratcheted up a notch in terms of quality in the last couple of months. And I don't know if I'm imagining it, and it's because I'm at home a lot, so it's much easier to get delivery, but it just feels like it's working quite well.
Definitely. I've ordered a lot of tat over the last few months, and I'd definitely say that's the case.
Yeah, the tat has arrived exactly when you wanted it to. Out of time. Lindsay, any more of a point of view from you on TV consumption? Yeah, we talk a lot about how, we don't understand, well, some of us at Exchange, well, I don't understand who watches linear TV. And you understand perfectly who watches linear TV.
Matt, I do.
Because in a way, you're probably one of them. You might not be watching it in a linear capacity, but you might be watching linear TV shows in a catch-up capacity, perhaps. But you know, Matt raised a good point. You know, have some of our traditional channels started, even if they're not running out of content, if you're an EastEnders fan and you're disappointed you can't get new episodes, what about things like Line of Duty? That was supposed to be a new season, was supposed to be filmed.
I'm not over that heartbreak yet.
I'm not over that either. Yeah, I don't think I'm going to get over it. I want to, you know, I think I've told you about a friend of mine who's a TV director. Well, you know, the next series of Bake Off has been filmed. Why can't they make bloody Line of Duty? Get out there.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the TV one's interesting because, I mean, I do watch linear TV channels, but I'm a Sky user, so technically it's not terrestrial TV in the same way. But I do view kind of channels, you know, view channels 1 to 4, and I think that a lot of the population still does, and there's been a lot of work in this country, I know in the US as well, with kind of the popular daytime more linear TV shows. Things like Loose Women, things like Saturday Night Takeaway with Ant and Dec, that have been trying to film them in their homes, try and make sure that people still are able to engage. But I think that because a lot of what we produce is live or filmed quite close to production and then being set live, being published, whereas Netflix already had their 2020 content done like at the start of the year. So this has not been a concern for them at all. And there's so much content on Netflix, you probably can't ever get... A friend of mine said he completed Netflix. I was like, oh, wow. He said, well, I'm a single man watching at home. Like, we know what else I'm going to do. I was like, yeah, fair enough. So I then said, have you watched this and this? He went, no, never heard of that. What's that? Is that on Netflix? I'm like, yeah. Oh, no, I didn't hear that.
Haven't completed Netflix.
So much you haven't discovered on Netflix.
Yeah.
And I think there's so much content everywhere. But I think that a lot of it as well, we can't underestimate the amount of content that would have been viewed by children. And Disney's 4% share in the US, you know, there'll be a lot of that. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I have been using lockdown to watch every episode of The Simpsons that have ever been made that is available on Disney Plus. So there'll be people like me doing that, but there will be a lot of kids content being watched in effort to entertain children while they've been stuck at home. And also an effort to entertain adults while they're not allowed to go out anywhere. But I feel that as things start to open again, I don't think CTV consumption will decline, but I think it will probably stabilize. I think people that have maybe taken out a Netflix subscription or an Amazon Prime subscription or a Disney, but I think that in terms of how they consume it, it might well start stabilizing rather than still seeing continued growth.
And that's a good point. And in fact, some of the figures that Group M released did say that there had been a dip in overall consumption. By 1%, not huge, but I guess it's to be expected because there'd been such an increase, right? And we didn't even sort of spend any great deal of time talking about the degree to which overall consumption habits might have changed for good, you know, not necessarily in TV, things like luxury and retail in general, because I know we all say, yeah, it will bounce back once life changes again, but I don't know. I kind of feel like maybe luxury is in for a bit of a longer term struggle. I feel like a lot of people might be asking themselves where they really want to spend money and why they really want to spend that money on those things, if you know what I mean. Even just, you know, the handbag example was good, you know, like you say, you don't need to bring your handbag to a Zoom call. But beyond that, it's just that we've all gotten used to moving around in a different way. And so, you know, we joked about it the other day, didn't we, that, you know, one of our colleagues left the house to go somewhere and was like, I don't have a stuff to put things in. What did I used to put things in? Oh, a handbag. Oh, where are they? They're like at the back of the cupboard. Now I just use like a hold all recyclable shopping bag. And, you know, it's been a long time we've been doing that now. Have our habits changed permanently? I think so.
I think also the super rich will still be super rich and they'll still go out and buy Louis Vuitton handbags.
For sure.
But the middle class people that might have saved up for a handbag and treat that as a super luxury item and might go and make that as like a once a year purchase or maybe once every 5 year purchase, those kind of people will not be doing that anymore because that money will be going somewhere else instead. I mean, it's not going on holidays, but it might be going on, you know, DIY is up massively, kind of some of the stats you read out, Rachel, kind of the non food and drink sector's up, kind of there's a lot of increase in hobbies, increase in DIY. People put their money there rather than on luxury goods, in my opinion. I know I am.
Yeah, definitely. What about you, Matt? You're not going to drive the Ferrari to a
Definitely not. I've been spending it on paint strippers and nails in the shed.
Excellent. Amazing. Right. Well, time's up, guys. Thank you very much. Excellent, speedy podcast. And thanks, everybody, for listening. That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.